Sorry. Vacation coming up.
Not soon enough?
Not soon.
No.
All right. Well,
it doesn't work because by the time I get back, I think like New Hampshire will be starting there soon, and then it's like
wait, New Hampshire?
Yeah. I think New Hampshire will be starting their break when we're like halfway done with ours.
Oh,
which
okay.
Which kind of messes everything up because my little brother goes to high school in New Hampshire, and so by the time he's on vacation, I'll be back here.
Which means you like him.
I'm still not used to the calendar. I'm not Jewish, so unfortunately I can't keep up with all these holidays.
Yeah, there's actually a great Facebook page called Jew Who Has It All. Do people know about this? Mm-hmm. It's really pretty hilarious. It's basically a person explaining the Christian calendar to the world. And she says, you know, it's just so weird how Christmas comes not only on a different day every year, but sometimes in a different month. But that's because the Gregorian calendar is so strange. And they don't even have leap months, which is weird. Like, most of their years are 12 months long, but they never have a 13th month. That's just so strange. So basically, she's saying, yeah, so sometimes Christmas comes, and she just names the Hebrew months that that Christmas will sometimes fall in. Mm-hmm. So the point is to take the Hebrew calendar as the thing that you are orienting yourself by, mm-hmm. and then explaining why these different holidays appear different days each year. Her Christian friends are celebrating and her Muslim friends are celebrating and so on. Although the Muslim calendar and the Hebrew calendar are a lot closer than the Gregorian calendar and the Hebrew calendar. So anyhow, it's good. It's fun. Here is a handout. And I'll just quickly tell you, well, they'll say what it is. It's a little bit of Hopkins, a little bit of Swinburne, a famous stanza from Swinburne that's not in Rick's anthology, from a famous poem of Swinburne's called The Triumph of Time, and a couple of sources for Swinburne's poem, The Garden of Proserpine, which I hope we'll look at. I was planning for us to finish the Rubaiyat, but we have so much to do, and I think you got it, what's going on in it. So even though it's great, and even though there are some more famous stanzas, like the hand writes and having writ moves on, and there's nothing you can do about it, there's also the tale of the pots. So just to tell you this, just if I can find it quickly now, since I stupidly pulled my pen out of my book. In case you were too busy with other less important things to look up all the references in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, on page 353 there is a section which is called Kutsa Nama, which translated means the tale of the pots. And it's a nice little allegory, just to say quickly, that it's a bunch of wine vessels that believe that God has created them out of God's creative desire to create beings with souls. But in fact, they're just vessels to hold wine. And the mistake that they're making is to imagine themselves, the center of the universe, the calendar by which all other things are oriented, to imagine that they're that, whereas in fact what they do is they hold wine. And in fact, they love holding wine. So they are like us. We are also created to hold wine. And that's what we should do all the time. So, and then the
end of the poem. Tamam shud means it is finished, and it just means the poem is over. But again, this is where Swinburne explicitly says that the moon is going to come again, but and seek us in the garden. Not Swinburne, Fitzgerald, you see what's on my mind, is going to seek us in the garden, but we're not there. We won't be there. So basically it's not carpe florum, it's not carpe diem, it's carpe vinum. Seize the wine, seize the drink. That's what you should be doing. Because it's all going to end anyhow, and none of it really matters. Okay, what I wanted us to do is spend a little bit of time on Meredith, on Modern Love, which is the strange sonnet sequence that, again, Ricks gives, it's 50 sonnets, the way Meredith wrote it. There's a later version which has an introductory sonnet, so that's 51 sonnets. But it's essentially 50 sonnets. Ricks only gives you 17 of them. So it's actually hard to read it as the narrative poem that it is. He gives you samples. So it's only a third of what really is a novel in sonnets. And I just, especially if you're interested, I know some of you got interested in EBB and in Aurora Leigh, if you're interested in this, it's something you could write about. You could read all 50 if you wanted, and that could be your second paper. But it's really fascinating, and there isn't going to be another course that you take anywhere that talks about it. Probably, even in grad school, if, like Irina, you are considering that route. So anyone want to take a really first, at whatever level of subtlety or approximation you want to take a stab at what Modern Love is about? I can think of a two-word approximation. All right, Modern Love. So what's so modern about this love? See, Quinn, I'm not putting you on the spot.
No, I refuse to.
Okay, what's so modern about this love? Oh, yes, remember there is a final exam, so you don't want to fall too far behind. Just a little reminder. So it is, first of all, the first thing to say about it is that it's a sonnet sequence. That might be a weird thing to say, or that might be the first surprise, since all the sonnets have 16 lines instead of 14. So a standard sonnet has 14 lines. That's not an absolute requirement for a sonnet to have 14 lines. It's usual. So the way we could say it is that empirically, most sonnets have 14 lines. Like the vast, vast majority of sonnets have 14 lines. But 14 lines don't define a sonnet. They don't have to have 14 lines. So, if you say a sonnet has 14 lines, you'll be right almost all the time. But Meredith decides to write these 16-line sonnets, except for that sonnet that he added much later at the beginning, which is a 14-line sonnet, which Ricks doesn't have. But these are 16-line sonnets. They are therefore in four quatrains. If you remember how a Shakespearean sonnet works, it's three quatrains and a couplet. What Meredith does is just has four quatrains. So what in Shakespeare would be two final lines, in Meredith it's four lines. And that's a little bit stylistically maybe what gives it a feeling of modernity, which is that there isn't this kind of summing up where the sonnet comes to a close. But instead, each sonnet does come to something of a close, but there's also something which is provisional about that close. There's rarely any point of okay, now this is where things are. That's satisfying. That's over. Things keep going. Sonnet sequences. Can people think of famous sonnet sequences before Meredith? Let's say less modern love. So a sonnet sequence where you get a bunch of sonnets in a row.
The Petrarchan sonnets?
Okay, so the Petrarchan sonnets. So in particular by? By Petrarch, yes. Yes, he named himself after the kind of sonnets he was writing. So he said, I'm going to write a bunch of Petrarchan sonnets. What name shall I give myself? Ah, Petrarch will work. No, that's not really true.
I was going to say.
Okay, yes. No, it's not really true. They're called Petrarchan sonnets because he wrote a lot of them about his relationship with
Laura.
Who may or may not have existed, and if she did exist, her name wasn't Laura. But he writes a lot of sonnets about his relation to this woman who is the speaker of those sonnets, is obsessed with her, and she's cruel and basically gives him permission to experience pain in not being able to... express his love for her, that she gives him that much permission. But anyhow, it's and there's a story that you can put together. Petrarch is pretty much the inventor of the sonnet, not the absolute inventor, but he's regarded as the inventor of the sonnet, of the 14-line sonnet, because he wrote so many of them, and because he turned them into a sequence. They then got to England... when Petrarchan sonnets were, there were some English poets who were obsessed with Petrarch and basically with Italian poetry in general. So Chaucer was actually the first English poet to bring great Italian poetry into England. He brought the Divine Comedy. The first copy of the Divine Comedy in England was brought to England by Chaucer, who had visited Italy on a diplomatic mission, and sort of introduced England to the great Italian poetry of the late medieval and early modern period. And then at the beginning of the 16th century, some other poets, most especially Thomas Wyatt, started translating some Petrarch sonnets into English. And Wyatt's translations, he also personalized them. That is, his translations are not accurate, but they apply to his own life. So what he does is he takes a sonnet, takes several sonnets, and reframes them so that they're applicable to his own tormented erotic life. And his torments were like Petrarch's, but not exactly the same. And then Wyatt, having essentially introduced the sonnet into English, people all through the 16th century and the 17th century started writing sonnets. So what they're doing in following Petrarch is they are more or less writing a novel as a sequence of sonnets. And it's important to see, some less, maybe like Spenser in the Amoretti, some more like Sidney in his great sonnet sequence called Astrophel and Stella. So Sir Philip Sidney was a friend of Spenser's. And they were both writing sonnet sequences. They are both slightly before Shakespeare. Their great work comes slightly before Shakespeare. And then Shakespeare and others write sonnet sequences partly because they're doing so. So just to tell you very quickly about Astrophel and Stella, which is Sidney's great sonnet sequence. Astrophel and Stella, the title literally means star, lover, and star. So Astrophel is astro, star, phil, lover. So like philosophy is love of wisdom. Astrophel is star, lover. Like Philadelphia is. What does Philadelphia mean? You didn't learn this in third grade, and none of you is from Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, but what's Delphia?
Adelphi, like Adelphi University. Means brother. Adelphos means brother.
Love, yeah.
City of brotherly love. You never heard that?
I think so.
So you learned something. Yay. The name Philadelphia means city of brotherly love. It's all Quaker, unlike Boston, which means city of puritanical hatred. Not literally, but that is the contrast that people in Philadelphia like to make. Philadelphia is a Quaker city, whereas Boston is a Puritan city. Okay, so Astrophel means lover of the stars in Greek. Stella is star in Latin, as in stellar, as in interstellar space. So Astrophel is in love with a married woman named Stella, and he's saying, oh, it's so terrible, I'm in love with a married woman, what am I going to do, I can't dishonor her, she's so great, and it's all self-pity. And then, to his surprise, she gets interested in him. And this is not what he was bargaining for. What he wanted, what the narrator of Astrophel and Stella, this is what makes it an interesting novel, what he wanted was an unattainable woman whom he could set his sights on and therefore feel self-pity, which is always a pleasant feeling, and write sonnets about his own self-pity. Self-pity is pleasant because you get to feel that life is unfair to you and that love is unfair to you and that you have the purest feeling for someone else, but they're not interested in you or they can't be or it's really bad. And what's really interesting about Astrophel and Stella is that Sydney is producing a work which is divergent between speaker of the sonnets and the poet writing that work. That is Sydney, I should tell you his name is Philip Sydney. Philip being a word that comes from?
Philo.
Which means?
Lover.
Yes. So Astrophel is a kind of coding of his name. Philip the star lover. Stella, people know who she was in real life. But this is really a fictionalized, this is fiction, Astrophel and Stella. So he falls in love with her and says, good, I get to write these sonnets about how hard things are for me because I'm in love with her and she's unattainable and I get to write all these wonderful sonnets. And then it turns out she's actually interested and she's actually a human being, which is not what he expected. Kind of shocking. And so the speaker and the poet are different. And what the poet is doing is presenting the way Browning does in My Last Duchess, is presenting a speaker who prefers self-pity to love and who, when it comes time to actually follow through on the commitments that he's implying in the sonnets that he's writing, because both the speaker and the poet are writing sonnets. That is, the poet produces a speaker who is writing sonnets. The way if someone is writing, the way in something like Amour de Voyage, Clough is producing Claude, who is writing these letters. So both the speaker and the poet are writing sonnets, but they don't have the same attitude towards them. The attitude of the speaker is, I'm writing these sonnets because I'm so in love with you and you're going to ignore me and I get to feel self-pity about this, but still I would rather have you than self-pity, blah, blah, blah. What Sydney is doing is writing about someone who is, it's a psychological portrait of someone who's experiencing great self-pity and whose self-pity wrongs others. So the idea of self-pity is, I'm the one who's in love with someone who will never, ever notice me, so I cannot possibly be in the wrong, which is a good feeling. That's one of the pleasures of self-pity, is that you can't be in the wrong. It's unfair to me. But in fact, he is in the wrong because she falls in love with him, and that's not what he wanted. And that puts him in a difficult position. And so it's subtle. I'm just giving you a very quick sense of how you can have a sonnet sequence which is a novel rather than an autobiography. And that's what Astrophel and Stella is. And that is also what modern love is. So modern love, remember that Meredith's wife left him for whom?
The painter.
That's the guy who painted this. His name escapes me.
Yes. His name escapes me. No, that's not his name. His name is Henry Wallace. So he posed for Chatterton. Wallace painted him. His wife left him for Wallace. And they were an amazing power couple. Meredith and Nichols. But she left him for Wallace, partly because she's a powerful and strong woman. Then she died 3 years later. Then he wrote Modern Love after she died. And Modern Love is, on first glance, it's no doubt based on real life, the way Astrophel and Stella is, but on first glance, it is, I feel very, very bitter because this woman that I trusted, my wife, whom I loved so much, left me for this other guy, and it's just so unfair, and I'm going to write 50 bitter sonnets about this. But that's not, in fact, what's going on. And one reason to mention Sidney as a precursor or a context for this is that Meredith is extremely, and I'm going to put it in parentheses, self-critical, which is, say, critical of the speaker of the sonnets. So the speaker of the sonnets is a version of Meredith, but this is not, the speaker is full of self-pity. Meredith is full of criticism for that self-pitying speaker, which is to say that it's self-criticism as well. That is to say, he is remorseless in analyzing his own attitudes in modern love. So it's a kind of first-person autofiction based on his real life, his real experience, but not one in which his account of himself is as naive as the speaker's account of himself is. Where what I mean by naivete there, but what I mean by the speaker is being naive, is that the speaker thinks, yes, anyone who reads this will see my point of view and see how badly I was treated. But that's not what you will get out of reading through all 50 sonnets. So as I say, I just want to give you some background here because unfortunately Rick's, you can't really tell this from the selections that Rick's makes. And I think partly he selects the poems that he does because they're really good standalone poems. You can feel that they're part of a sequence, but it would be really hard not to be confusing unless you put all of Modern Love in the anthology. And I think he should have, but he didn't. And you're probably grateful that he didn't, but nevertheless. That's something to know about it. So here is the difference. Here's a way of talking about the difference between Modern Love and Astrophel and Stella, which is that Astrophel and Stella it's a love triangle, a triangle of desire, which is that Astrophel is in love with a married woman named Stella who seems determined to stay loyal to her husband, although it becomes fairly probable that she doesn't actually love her husband. And one of the things she tells Astrophel is, look, I feel about you that you're amazing and, you know, it's your love for me is really meaningful, but we have to be virtuous. And Astrophil says, okay, yes, we have to be virtuous. I quite agree. This is an ideal love. It's platonic in the non-sexual sense, as opposed to the other meaning of platonic, which is in the sexual sense. It's platonic in the non-sexual sense. And I will just look at you and idealize you at every moment because you're a star, and I love stars. But then one famous sonnet says this for 13 lines, and then the 14th line of the sonnet is, but still, desire cries out, give me some food. That is, yeah, but I desire you, I can't. I can't even, essentially. So, actually, it's not I can't even, but still. So, what you are getting is this triangle in which you have a lover who really loves the married woman, whose husband doesn't really love her because he's an old fart idiot, and she is trapped in a loveless marriage. But it seems, but the speaker regrets the fact that she's trapped in that marriage, and says that he wishes that she weren't. But when she's willing to go farther than he ever imagined that she would, he kind of panics. So that's what happens in Astrophil and Stella. Here, the story is that the wife, who is called Madam throughout, so there are only a couple of sonnets in Rix's version that use the word Madam, but the wife who's called Madam throughout is the speaker's wife. It's not that she's married to someone else and the speaker longs for her, impossible though it might be, which is a standard medieval troubadour situation. But here, it is the speaker is the husband and his wife is having an affair, a love affair, I mean, put it strongly, a love affair with someone else, and he's the one doing the complaining. So that's the first reversal to notice that Meredith does, is that this is the point of view of the husband whose wife is interested in someone else. But then, and this is the other important innovation, look at... number 14, which I distributed, which is not in the book, but which I distributed on last Wednesday. This, I have two more copies of it if anyone needs it. Oh, Quincy, you need it?
He heard the paper was
coming. Oh, I see.
I have one.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And you need one. So, yeah.
Sorry.
Okay, so just to see what happens in 14. Someone read it. I am going to look at the first letter, which is a W, and I'm going to wonder who... Well, Leon, that makes it you.
Okay, sure. So what soul would bargain for a cure that brings contempt and noble agony to kill? Rather let me bear on the bitter ill and strike this rusty bosom with new things. It seems there is another veering fit, since on a gold-eared lady's eyeball was pure and looked with little prospect of a cure. The while her mouth read bold loose shafts of wit. Just heaven, can it be true that jealousy has decked the woman thus, and thus her head swim somewhat for possessions forfeited? Madam, you teach me many things that be. I open an old book, and there I find that women still may love whom they deceive.
Yeah, forget the PP, I don't know where that came from.
Such love I prize not, madam. By your leave, the game you play is not to my mind.
Okay, great. All right, so first thing to notice, if you look at the first sonnet on page 367 of Rix. So first I made you close it, Sophia, and now I'm making you open it. Page 367. By this he knew she wept with waking eyes.
Compare that to the sixth line, 1, 2, 3, 4, seventh line of number 14. What's the difference?
Goes from third person to first person.
Yeah, goes from third to first person. So what you will see if you read through all of Modern Love is that there are interesting moments where the same figure is sometimes described in the third person and sometimes described in the first. And Meredith is just really subtle at going from one to the other in ways that I won't go strongly into here, but he's really subtle at are not even noticing that he's gone from third to first person. But that's one way that he has of making us see that the first person narrator is actually a character, which is why the third word of the poem is he rather than I. Not by this I knew she wept with waking eyes, but by this he knew she wept with waking eyes. So first really interesting thing is that there's an inconsistency of person, but it has to do with the extent to which we are getting what our perspective on self-pity is. So the sequence is a self-pitying one, and sometimes the pitier is the speaker, that is someone writing a third-person narrative in which he pities a character, or more than one character, but in which he pities a character. And sometimes he is the self that is pitied, and then it tends to be first-person. So it is about self-pity, and that's what Meredith wants it to be about, and about the ways in which self-pity is basically an unpleasant feature of someone. You go around, you know, if someone's self-pitying, you can be patient with them for a while, but after a while, you know, enough. That's just a human response to other people's, you know, you're pitying yourself so well, why do I have to pity you? We're much more willing to pity people who don't pity themselves. Then we're impressed by them. But if they're pitying themselves, okay, yeah. That's what my grandmother was like. She was just a monster of self-pity. And it was just, I now pity her for being such a monster of self-pity because no one wanted to talk to her. And so Meredith is just really good at going back and forth between the person doing the pity and the person who wants to be pitied. So self-pity, it's like you're split in two. Someone pities you. Who's that? Oh, you. And someone is pitied. Who's that? Oh, it's you pitying yourself. And in this sequence, you can tell a kind of difference between those things. Okay, so let's just look. We're not going to spend too much more time on this. I just want to give you a kind of introduction to it. But just look at what's going on in Sonnet 14. So what soul would bargain for a cure that brings contempt, the nobler agony to kill? So a cure that brings contempt from whom?
From whom or for whom?
Say it again.
From whom or for whom?
Well, it would be, okay, so for whom?
Okay. I would assume either for his wife or the person with whom she is involved.
Okay, so how would who would be experiencing the nobler agony then? Meredith is hard. There's no question about that. His syntax is hard and convoluted, but nobler agony. Who would the speaker want to apply the word nobler to?
Himself.
Okay, good. So what soul would bargain for a cure that kills the nobler agony if that cure would bring contempt? So who would the contempt be for? Who would be rendered ignoble?
Himself.
by the cure. Yeah, yeah. So who is going to take on a cure that would get him over agony at the price of being the object of contempt, maybe self-contempt, at the price of doing something that he regards as contemptuous, in order not to feel something nobler, even though it's agony? Okay, so do you see that? It's a rhetorical question. The answer is no noble soul. So what soul would bargain for a cure that brings contempt in order to kill the nobler agony? So he's representing himself as someone feeling nobler agony, and he says, I am certainly not the kind of soul that would do something that would bring contempt to me in order to avoid feeling that nobler agony. That is where the rhetorical question is going. Okay, does that make sense? So who would do that? Not me. Rather, let me bear on the bitter ill. So that tells you for sure who is feeling the bitter ill. Bitter ill there is synonymous with nobler agony. Rather, not synonymous, I mean, it's same referent. He's referring to the same thing. So rather let me bear on the bitter ill and strike this rusty bosom with new stings. So I'd rather keep feeling the same ill. My bosom is rusty because it's been going on for a long time, but new stings, yeah, let it happen. It seems there is another veering fit. So, veering fit, that's not really a term, but he is worried about something, and he uses what is a kind of abstract phrase, and you don't quite know who to assign it to, but it seems there is another veering fit, another fit of veering, since on a gold-haired lady's eyeballs pure, I looked with little prospect of a cure, the while her mouth's red bow loosed shafts of wit. So there's another veering fit. Why? What happened? What did he do? Since what?
I mean, like, since he first fell in love with his wife, there's been a new, like, more treacherous feeling.
Okay, about whom?
About her.
So the gold-haired lady is not his wife. So that's the important thing. It turns out there's a fourth character in this poem who is as major as the other three. So the cure that would kill the nobler agony, but would be a cure, even though it would open him to contempt, is he sees another woman. And he's not quite sure what to do about it. Here's another veering fit, where veering means veering off from the feeling you're supposed to be having. It means, we would call it straying. Another straying fit is happening here. So it seems there's another veering fit. Why? Since on a gold-haired lady's eyeballs pure, I looked with little prospect of a cure, the while her mouth's red bow loosed shafts of wit. So I was just looking around, not, you know, just feeling sorry for myself, and I looked on this other lady, and what was she doing? What did I notice about her? If you were painting her, what do you know about how to paint her?
She's got blonde hair.
She's got blonde hair.
The eyeball's pure.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know. It's not like, oh my God, it can only be this one person. But the point is, he's seeing her erotically. So he's just looking around. He didn't, you know, so okay, he meets this person. He didn't think anything of it. He's talking to her, but suddenly, wait, wow, she's kind of hot. Is he sees to his surprise. So if he yields to his erotic feeling for her, he would feel open to contempt. So he looks, he didn't think that would happen, but then he sees her, and not only is she beautiful, but she's also very witty. Her mouth's red bow loosed shafts of wit. That is, it's like a bow loosing, loosing arrows. Shafts are arrows there. So he meets this woman, and she's beautiful and smart, and he's not quite sure what he should be feeling about his own feelings there. So, just heaven, he asks. Can it be true that jealousy has decked the woman thus? So why does she look so beautiful to him?
Is it just because I'm jealous?
Yeah, because I am jealous of my wife having this affair with someone else. And is that why I'm finding this other woman so hot? Could that be it? And does her head swim somewhat for possessions forfeited? That is, am I seeing her head? Are my eyes swimming as I see her head? Am I seeing her? Am I swooning at her beauty because of the possessions that I have forfeited, namely the possession of the monogamy of my own wife? Is that what's going on? And then he turns to his wife and says, "Madam." So suddenly he's blaming her. "Madam, you teach me many things that be. So I've learned a whole lot from you, allegedly. Here's one of the things that you teach. I open an old book, which confirms what you've taught, and there I find that women still may love whom they deceive." So what does he learn from this old book? Women may still may love whom they deceive. What does that mean? Paraphrase.
They can still lie to people that they love. Or they might still care about someone even if they're doing it wrong.
Yeah, stop taking sexual cheating too seriously. Doesn't mean she doesn't love you. Doesn't mean that this is a betrayal on the level of the soul. Yeah, so she's having sex with someone else. You may not like it. It may not be nice. You should talk to her about it. But don't act. Or don't think, don't believe that this is proof of a disloyalty so profound that you are simply its victim because you trusted in her love and she didn't love you. You may have trusted in her fidelity, but don't confuse fidelity with love. That is what the old book is saying. And so he's learning this lesson. Because, yes, I love her so much, it's so terrible. Whoa, this other woman is kind of hot. But I love her so much, even though, yeah, I would sleep with this other woman. But that doesn't mean I don't love her. I do love my wife. I'm really miserable that she's been unfaithful to me. I would like to sleep with this other woman, and in fact, I will. So that proves that you can love someone and still sleep with someone else. But I am a jerk. And I am refusing to understand that. So in the same way as in Astrophel and Stella, Astrophel doesn't imagine that Stella could actually be a person. So too the speaker in Modern Love is not imagining that his wife could be a person. He's imagining that she is simply an object, a possession, who either will stay faithful to him, which is what he wants, or won't, in which case he gets to be angry and bitter. But he's not treating her as a full person, just as Astrophel is surprised to find that Stella is a full person. So he gets very cold to her. "Madam, you teach me many things that be. I open an old book, and there I find that women still may love whom they deceive." "Ha! Not me. Such love I prize not, madam. By your leave, the game you play at is not to my mind." So, again, this is this is an important sonnet, I think. Many of them are consistent with this, but it's an important sonnet because what he's essentially saying is, I do some self-analysis. I see that it's possible to be attracted by someone else, even if you love the person who is the person that you truly love. I see that it's possible even to be unfaithful without that meaning anything about whether you actually love the person to whom you're being unfaithful. That's my own discovery. But you were unfaithful to me and I'll never forgive you. So he is making her, his possessiveness of her is such that he is refusing the lesson that he could learn from some slight examination of his own, some slightly deep, some not entirely shallow examination of himself. What he is saying is, yeah, I see that this can happen, but no, I'm still contemptuous of you for the fact that you were unfaithful, even as I am being pulled towards unfaithfulness. If a guy does it, it's okay, especially if the person he loves is already cheating. Then it's okay for me to do it, even as I continue to blame you and feel contempt for the fact that you're cheating. So this is going to be the motif in this poem. There are four figures, and he and his wife are essentially like each other in that they are both having to distinguish between sexual desire and real love, and not think that one always implies the other, and that sexual desire can never lead you astray without its nevertheless saying nothing about whether you love the other person. So what happens in modern love, it becomes clearer and clearer, is that he wants to leave her, and she actually doesn't want to break up. She loves him, but he doesn't love her. Yeah, she's the first person to cheat, but what he won't do is admit to himself that he's actually glad, because it gives him an excuse. And so what happens in the course of the poem, there's one poem where you can see something like this happening, is, let's see, I thought it was in here. Yeah, if you go to 23, just look quickly at 23. 'Tis Christmas weather and a country house receives us. So they are keeping up appearances. They're staying at a country house. It's cold. It's Christmas weather. They're still officially married, and they go around together, even though behind the scenes he's full of rage and bitterness. 'Tis Christmas weather and a country house deceives us. Rooms are full. We can but get an attic crib. So they have to go stay in the attic. Such lovers will not fret at that, it is half said. So, oh, you're such a beautiful couple. You won't mind being in this little room in the attic, right? The great carouse knocks hard upon the midnight's hollow door, but when I knock at hers, I see the pit. So everyone is partying. She's gone upstairs. He knocks at the door because that's where he has to stay, and he sees the pit. Why did I come here in that dullard fit? I enter and lie couched upon the floor. So he goes inside and he lies on the floor. Passing, I caught the coverlet's quick beat. Come, shame, burn to my soul in pride and pain, foul demons that have tortured me in chain. Out in the freezing darkness, the lambs bleat. So she's in bed and she's moving and she's restless. The small bird stiffens in the low starlight. So, do you need to think about that line twice? So everyone gets the metaphor there? Okay. The small bird stiffens in the low starlight. I know not how, but shuddering as I slept, I dreamed a banished angel to me crept. My feet were nourished on her breasts all night. So he dreamed, or was it a dream, that she came to him, that they lay head to toe, head to feet, but kept each other warm. And he's surprised. But it seems to be, and there are many poems of this, where that's what she wants. Okay, take a look at the first one. Very interesting first two words. By this, so by what, we don't know. But by this he knew she wept with waking eyes, and then we find out what the this is, that at his hands light quiver by her head, the strange low sobs that shook their common bed were called into her with a sharp surprise, and strangled mute like little gaping snakes, dreadfully venomous to him. So now we get the scene, the opening scene. She is lying in bed, weeping quietly, pretending to be asleep, but he knew that she wasn't asleep. How did he know? Because as soon as he touches her, she stops sobbing. So notice that this is like that Patmore poem about kissing someone who is awake, who he thinks she's asleep, or in fact, he thinks she's asleep. Here's the tragic version of that. And it's an amazing opening. Amazing breakup opening, that they are in this situation where they can't communicate. But still, he gets how she feels. Notice that that's a third person opening. By this he knew she wept with waking eyes. By what? By the fact that at his hands like quiver by her head, the strange low sobs that shook their common bed were called into her with a sharp surprise and strangled mute, like little gaping snakes, dreadfully venomous to him. She lay stone still, and the long darkness flowed away with muffled pulses. Then, as midnight makes her giant heart of memory and tears drink the pale drug of silence, and so beat sleep's heavy measure, they from head to feet were moveless, looking through their dead black years. So they just lie there without moving, each awake, but pretending to think the other is asleep. By vain regret, looking back through their dead black years, by vain regret scrawled over the blank wall. Like sculptured effigies, they might be seen upon their marriage tomb, the sword between, each wishing for the sword that severs all. So it begins with they're being unhappy with each other, lying there completely still, each wishing for the sword that severs all. Yeah.
And when it's written in the third person, we're supposed to take that for truth, right? Like that they both are genuinely wanting the marriage to end, but then wanting changes tense then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. When you get the when you get the first person, you get the self-pitier. Okay. One more sonnet, if you look at the other thing that I handed out. So the last sonnet, sonnet 50, which is in the book, is kind of the conclusion of all. But here's sonnet 49. He found her by the ocean's moaning verge, nor any wicked change in her discerned, and she believed his old love had returned, which was her exaltation and her scourge. So he goes, third person again, he goes, he finds her somewhere by the ocean, they meet up again, and she somehow believes that he, that his old love had returned. So notice who the real person who is unhappy is, who is unhappy is here. She believed his old love had returned, which was her exaltation, that would make her happy, and her scourge, it would also make her feel guilty. She took his hand and walked with him and seemed the wife he sought, though shadow-like and dry. She had one terror lest her heart should sigh and tell her loudly that she no longer dreamed. So she's afraid she was a dream, that this was a dream. And she was worried. There they were, walking hand in hand by the sea. She was worried that she would wake up and find out it was a dream. Her heart would tell her that. She dared not say, "This is my breast, look in." But there's a strength to help the desperate weak. That night he learned how silence best can speak the awful things when pity pleads for sin. So what happens is that night he doesn't spend with her. And learned how terrible things can be when she looks for pity, rather because he can't, that's the only thing he can feel for her. About the middle of the night, her call was heard, and he came wondering to the bed. "Now kiss me, dear, maybe now," she said. Lethe had passed those lips, and he knew all. So what's happened is she's killed herself. That's what happens in this penultimate sonnet. Why? Because he's cruel to her. How is he cruel to her? Because he will not forgive her for her adultery. So he is the one who's in the wrong. He is the one who takes up with another woman out of revenge. And then, or at least he imagines it's revenge, but maybe revenge is the excuse. And then finally, we get stanza 50, the last stanza, the last sonnet. I think we don't have time to do it, but it itself is pretty powerful. Anyhow, I just wanted to give you a sense of what an amazing story modern love tells and how amazingly it tells it. And it's not at all what you're expecting from a sequence of poems about how, oh, I was so in love with her, but she didn't respond to my love or return it, and I'm such a sad, sad poet. This is a poem about feeling really good about yourself because you're a sad, sad poet, and then finding out that feeling good about yourself because you're a sad, sad poet makes you a total jerk, and learning that as well. So it is very cool that way. Okay, let us, what we are doing this week is Hopkins, mainly what we're doing this week is Hopkins and Swinburne. And we'll spend more time on Hopkins on Wednesday. But I wanted to show you the poem called Binsey Poplars, which is not in the book, so it's really on the second page that I handed out, but the title just got there on the first page. The note, it should probably be in italics, spelled 1879, is that there's some poplar trees that were cut down to Hopkins's great distress. So let's see. No one's name starts with an M. Yes, Red.
Technically. Never mind.
Oh, yes, you're right. You're right. Of course it does. Technically. Yes, so you get to read it.
My aspen steer, whose airy cage is quelled, quelled or quenched in leaves the weeping sun, all felled, felled, are all felled, of a fresh and following folded rank, not spared, not one, that dandled a sandaled shadow that swam or sank, on meadow and river and wind-wandering weed-winding bank. Oh, if we but knew what we do when we delve or hew, hack and rack the growing green, since country is so tender, to touch her being so slender, that, like this sleek and seeing ball, but a prick will make no eye at all, where we, even where we mean to mend her, we end her. When we hew or delve, aftercomers cannot guess the beauty bend. 10 or 12, only 10 or 12, strokes of havoc on self, the sweet especial scene, rural scene, a rural scene, sweet especial rural scene.
Thank you, beautiful. So this is a great poem, pure and simple. It's also a great ecological poem about chopping down these trees. And those aspens are gone. Just again, quickly to gloss it. Their airy cages quelled. Notice the Q's, quelled. Quelled or quenched in leaves the leaping sun. So looking through the aspen leaves, what do you see? The sun, and it's as though the sunlight is in a kind of bird cage within the aspen leaves. Mm-hmm. And what's happened to the aspen's deer?
Felled.
Yeah, and notice that repetition. All felled, felled, are all felled. And so there was a fresh and following folded rank of trees, that is just a bunch of trees by the water. Notice the alliterations which Hopkins is intent on, as in quelled or quenched. Here you have a fresh and following folded rank. Of all of those, how many were spared?
None of them.
Yeah, not one. Not spared, not one. That dandled a sandal shadow. So you could see the shadows of the leaves in the water. That swam or sank on meadow and river and wind-wandering, weed-winding bank. So because they're being blown by the wind, and you can see their shadow on the meadow and the river and the bank, but they're all gone. And then the, oh, if we but knew what we do when we delve or hew, when we dig or cut, delve or hew, hack and rack the growing green. Because the countryside is tender to touch. Its being is slender. Notice the accent on so, her being so slender. So the being of nature is so thin that, like the eyeball, but a prick will make no eye at all. And so where we mean to mend her, we end her. We destroy nature. When we hew or delve, when we cut or dig. And then people later cannot guess the beauty that was here. It just took 10 or 12 strokes of the axe. 10 or 12, only 10 or 12 strokes of havoc, unselve. Amazing word there, amazing verb, unselve. Won't work on Lexulus, just so you know. 10 or 12 strokes of havoc on self, the sweet, especial scene. So this is the special scene, and 10 or 12 blows of the axe and it's gone. That self is gone, unself, as though it had a self. And then the last two lines are just, I think, incredible. where he can't go on. The sweet especial scene, rural scene, a rural scene, sweet especial rural scene. There's nothing else that he can say except to lament. And that lamentation, it's just, it's amazing. It's one of those Victorian poems where the last lines are not what you would expect as last lines. Again, we talked about this a little bit before. The last line that's an absolute last line is Child Roland to the Dark Tower came. That has to be the climactic last line of that poem. But something like, and thou returning on thy silver wheels, doesn't feel like a last line. And the fact that it is a last line, I'm sure you all remember that's the last line of Tithonus. The fact that it is a last line is part of the surprising point, that the dawn will just keep returning on her silver wheels. And there's no end to that, because Tithonus will just continue to grow older forever. So here, the last lines are not some kind of reconciliation, some kind of sense of achieved tragedy, which is something that you often get in tragedy, which is finality. Whatever else a sad poem tends to give you, it's finality. At the end of Modern Love, she kills herself. That's finality. And then he realizes in the 50th sonnet, which we didn't look at, the meaning of the emptiness of it all. So there's an achievement, even in sad poetry, which is the achievement of finality, which to some extent counterweighs the very sadness it's about. It's how mourning is supposed to work, which is you now see truth, let's say, that a standard sad poem will end with, it's all gone, but I have achieved a truth that I didn't have before. Before I lived in an illusory world, but now I've achieved a truth. So just notice this in any sad poem that you read, any sad song that you hear, that the ends of those songs are, give you the sense of an achieved clarity, even at the expense of happiness. There's something that you get in exchange for the happiness that you've lost. Yeah?
It kind of reminds me of that, like, three-horned flower poem.
Yes, nice.
Yeah, with the last lines. It's supposed to be inconclusive, but that in itself is conclusive almost.
Yeah, the Woodspurge has a cup of three. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great connection to make. So there's one thing that I take from this, which is the Woodspurge has a cup of three. Yeah, so even that is a truth. And it, you know, it may not be a truth that anyone will feel, yes, it was worth learning that, but it is a kind of achievement of now I see clearly. There's clarity at the end of tragedy. And that's a perfect example of it. Okay. That's not what you get here. It's just like, what can he say? A rural scene, sweet, especial rural scene. It's just weeping without that weeping turning into some kind of knowledge. Again, a standard way of putting it is to say, and this is the way Wordsworth puts it, is that knowledge comes at the cost of power. But at least you get the knowledge. Knowledge purchased at the cost of power is, I'm leaving a word out intentionally, but that's Wordsworth's idea. And that's not what you're getting in Hopkins. So we're going to return to Hopkins on Wednesday. But let's look at Swinburne. And I think what we'll have time to do now is, first of all, look at this famous stanza from The Triumph of Time, which is a longish poem, and which Rix doesn't put in here, unfortunately, but a good poem. So someone want to read it? Let's see. Close enough, Julia. No, what am I saying? Arena. Closer still. It's like 70% of the guesses of everyone else.
Wait, sorry, which page?
It's the handout. Today's handout.
Oh, I will go back to the great sweet mother, mother and lover of men this evening. I will go down to her, I and none other, close with her, kiss her, and mix her with me. Cling to her, strive with her, hold her fast. O fair white mother, in days long past, born without sister, born without brother, set free my soul as thy soul is free.
Great. So that is a very famous stanza, and it's typical of Swinburne, as in there's this desire in him with to merge with and join some kind of totality. Here he's representing it as the sea. How many people have tried at least the first few pages of Ulysses? No one? So what are you doing this summer?
The Joyce one? Or
the Joyce, yeah, not the Tennyson. Yeah, no, one interesting thing about Ulysses, the novel, is that Ulysses, the poem, is never mentioned. In fact, almost no reference to, there's a reference to every single, explicit references to every single mythology you can imagine from any part of the world, except for Homer's Odyssey, which is what, do people know about how Ulysses works? It's a single day. Do you know? Can you say more?
It's been a while.
Okay, it's all right. It's a single day in Dublin, June 16th, 1904, sometimes called Bloom's Day now because the main character is Leopold Bloom. And it's a 700-page novel that all takes place in a single day over the course of roughly 18 hours, although it's not quite clear what time it is when it ends. It ends in a kind of timeless 4 a.m. The next day, June 17th. And in it, the three main characters do things in Dublin that day. They go about their business. One of them goes to a funeral. Another one has to teach a class because he's really heroic. I mean, what could be more heroic than that? And another, the wife of the guy who goes to the funeral and has lunch and does various other things, she stays home and has an affair with someone that day. So it's basically what happens on this single day. That's not a spoiler. It's basically what happens in that single day. But unbeknownst to any of the characters, they are repeating all the stuff that happens in the Odyssey. And so the young man is Telemachus, the middle-aged man who goes about his day and goes to funeral and so on is Odysseus, Leopold Bloom is. When he goes to funeral, that's like Odysseus going to the underworld in Book 11 of the Odyssey, as I'm sure you recall. And his wife is Penelope, who is the faithful wife waiting for Odysseus to return from his ventures in the Trojan War. The Odyssey takes place over the course of 10 years. Ulysses takes place over the course of a single day. And the reason I bring it up is at the very beginning of Ulysses, the Telemachus character, Stephen Dedalus, has anyone read Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man? So Stephen Dedalus is the same, is the main character of Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. He's Telemachus in Ulysses. Stephen Dedalus is... talking to his friend Buck Mulligan, who is a very irreverent person. And among the things they do is they quote poetry, including Yeats. They quote a Yeats poem that we're going to get to, which is, "And no more turn aside and brood upon love's bitter mystery, for Fergus rules the brazen cars and all the lanterns of the wood and wandering vast disheveled stars." So that's one poem that Stephen quotes, but his friend Buck Mulligan says they're right by the Irish Sea, and Buck Mulligan says, "God, isn't the sea what Algy calls it? Our great green mother, the snot green sea, he goes on, making fun of algae, which is, say, Algernon Swinburne. So what he is thinking of is this: the sea is our fair white mother. I will go down, I will go back to the great sweet mother, mother and lover of men, the sea. And that is typical of the feeling that you get in Swinburne's poetry. Okay, so what we're going to do, we have a couple minutes, so I just want to do this now prepare for the Swinburne part of Wednesday's class, is we're going to look at his poem on the Garden of Proserpine. And he is thinking of a couple of famous passages in English literature. So the first one is the Garden of Adonis passage in The Faerie Queen. And the Garden of Adonis is a mythological place where everyone is happy. So, and they would be totally happy were it not, so this is the second passage on the handout, but were it not the time their troubler is, all that in this delightful garden grows should happy be and have immortal bliss. For here all plenty and all pleasure flows, and sweet love gentle fits amongst them throws, without fell rancor or fond jealousy. Frankly, each paramour his leman knows, each bird his mate, nay, any does envy their goodly merriment and gay felicity. So it's a garden of love. There is continual spring and harvest there. So it's both fall and spring there always. Continual, both meeting at one time, for both the boughs do laughing blossoms bear, and with fresh colors deck the wanton prime. So they have blossoms, and eke at once the heavy trees they climb. The trees are heavy with fruit, so blossom and fruit at the same time, which seem to labor under their fruit's load. The wiles the joyous birds make their pastime amongst the shady leaves, their sweet abode, and their true loves without suspicion tell abroad. And then Milton in Paradise Lost is thinking of the Garden of Adonis when he describes the Garden of Eden. And here's his description of the Garden of Eden. And Milton does something here that he does all the time, which is he describes other amazing places to say, my place is even better than this. But his descriptions of these other places are actually the heart of Paradise Lost. So here is Eden. The birds their choir apply. Airs, vernal airs, breathing the smell of field and grove, attune the trembling leaves. While universal Pan, knit with the graces of the hours and dance, led on the eternal spring. That's Eden. And you can hear how it's like the Garden of Adonis. Not that fair field of Anna, where Proserpine, gathering flowers, herself a fairer flower by gloomy Dis was gathered, which cost Ceres all that world to seek her, all that pain to seek her through the world, might with this paradise of Eden strive. So Eden is so beautiful, it's even more beautiful than the place where Proserpine was gathering flowers when Dis or Hades kidnapped her and brought her to the underworld. Even that amazing place wasn't as beautiful as Eden. But what Milton is doing is describing that amazing place where Proserpine, gathering flowers herself, a fairer flower, by gloomy Dis was gathered, which caused her mother Ceres all that pain to seek her through the world. So that is on Swinburne's mind in his poem, which we will look at for the first half of class on Wednesday, the Garden of Proserpine. Okay, see you then. See, now you're all happy again that it's not vacation because his poetry is so great, right?